Saturday morning, April 21st, and time for a report from the Pacific. Each week at this time, Mutual presents a complete roundup of Pacific news with reports from the various battlefronts and commentary by Mutual newsmen. This morning, the fight for Okinawa rages fiercely, with the enemy slowly yielding to the heavy pressure of our lines. But now, for our first report of the morning, we take you to Guam and Mutual war correspondent Jack Mann. Go ahead, Jack Mann, at Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam.
This is Jack Mann reporting from Pacific Fleet Headquarters on Guam. The fight for Okinawa is on. After almost 2 weeks of lining up supplies, eagerness, and tension, our 24th Army Corps tonight is slugging ahead yard by yard in the final drive to knock out the main Jap defense garrison in and around the capital city of Naha. Admiral Nimitz's communique today reveal that we've made an advance of roughly 1,000 yards since striking off early yesterday. This, measured against the gains of mile after mile made on the European front, does not seem very impressive. As usual, gains in the Pacific are measured in yards. Those in Europe are usually measured in miles. Up on Okinawa, however, a yard at the moment is the equivalent of a mile. We are running into some of the toughest fighting of the Pacific War on the Okinawa front, and the full story will not be written until some months after the last shot is fired. I have talked to some men who have just returned from the island, and the picture they paint is anything but pleasant. Not that they have any doubt that we will win the battle in reasonable time. The story I heard this afternoon illustrates the point. Our lines are roughly 4 miles north of the bomb-happy city of Naha. Three Army divisions striking down the eastern and western coasts, respectively, are running into the heaviest artillery fire we have experienced in months. The Japs, and there are approximately 60,000 of them dug in to die, are holed in around three hills which form a triangle blocking the approaches to Naha. These hills range from 500 to 700 feet in height. They are filled with caves and interlocking tunnels. The tunnels, I understand, are the result of careful planning and not necessarily the work of a beneficent Mother Nature. Approaches to the caves are from 8 to 10 feet in length, with mouths large enough to permit two men to fire shoulder to shoulder at our approaching troops. Beyond the mouths of the caves, however, there are corridors and tunnels leading back into the bowels of the hills, large enough to accommodate an entire company of the enemy. The Japs are dug in on an uneven line running across the island. We are fighting against heavy artillery, machine gun, and light arms fire. Our Marine and Army heavy artillery units are shelling the enemy throughout the day, assisted by supporting bombardment from heavy Navy guns and carrier-based planes. At this writing, the 7th Infantry Division has made the most progress, penetrating about 1,400 yards down the eastern coast. The town of Yanabaru, which is almost directly opposite Naha on the opposite coast, is virtually in ruins. The enemy is now fighting with all he has. He is dug in depth in a narrow corridor, and he cannot retreat. Behind him lies the sea. He must fight or die. He will choose to do both. There is no telling how long it will take to crack the major resistance in this last gasp battle for an already ruined Naha and the two airfields toward which we are pushing. But it seems a safe guess to assume the last Jap will not be routed out of his cave defenses for a long time to come. In the northern part of the island, the Marines of the 3rd Amphibious Corps continue to move ahead over rugged terrain. Small groups of the enemy have been pocketed on the Motobo Peninsula, which sticks out like a sore thumb on the western coast, and are being steadily annihilated. Admiral Nimitz, for the first time today, also announced a complete list of our ships sunk in the Okinawa operation and during associated attacks on Japan from March 18th to April 18th. We lost the destroyers Hilligan, Bush, Calhoun, M.L. Abilene, and the Pringle. We also lost a minecraft, a destroyer transport, one gunboat, an LST, an LCI, an LCS, an LCT, and a couple of ammunition ships. During the same period, the Japs lost 2,569 aircraft, the battleship Yamato, two light cruisers, five destroyers, five destroyer escorts, four large cargo ships, a medium cargo ship, 28 small cargo ships, and 54 smaller craft. Though the main actions in the last 48 hours has been on the ground, there has been no slackening of our aerial assault on the Jap home islands. The number one target has been switched in the last week from Tokyo to Kyushu. On the latter island, honeycombed with airstrips, we have discovered the Jap's base for the recent all-out suicidal attacks on our forces supporting the Okinawa campaign. Today, for the third time, we sent a large task force of more than 200 B-29s up over Kyushu to blast at these futility fields. So far, there has been an agreeable lack of fighter interception, and we have been able to do considerable damage to the suicide air forts from a medium altitude. I return you now to the Mutual Broadcasting System in the United States.
That was Mutual War Correspondent Jack Mann reporting from Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam. Now, for a further late word on the Battle of the Ryukyus, we call in War Correspondent Leslie Nichols, reporting direct from Ieshima. Go ahead, Leslie Nichols.
This is Leslie Nichols speaking from Okinawa. The fight for the little island of Ieshima has been reduced to a contest for an overgrown anthill. The Japs, with their predilection for digging, have so completely infested Ieguasugiyama, or Pinnacle Hill, on Ieshima, that our doughboys have made little, if any, real progress in reaching the summit. The defenders have converted the peak, which dominates the island, into a bristling fortress on all sides. They appear to be all over, inside, and underneath. Interlocking underground corridors, hewn from rock and earth, render the Japs impervious to artillery and bombs. The GIs charge and charge again, only to be driven back down to cover. Yesterday, our men tried five times to push up the slope. On each occasion, Jap mortar and machine gun fire, directed from the most cunningly concealed position, repulsed attempts at dislodgement. In the town of Ieshima, resting at the base of the pinnacle, resistance continues in the rubble of buildings, walls, and monuments. There is no static line of defense. What our men possess today, they lose overnight, or vice versa. Since the Japs can always retire to the peak, which protects their rear, they hold a heavy advantage over our boys. But there is no abatement of this savage contest from mountain and town. And at the end of each day's fighting, it's the enemies who dead outnumber ours. Our own casualties, particularly the wounded, are serious for our forces involved, because few men are victims of shrapnel or surface wounds. In this close-range fighting, Jap bullets found their mark with frightening accuracy. Although we have surrounded Ieguasugiyama, occupying all the rest of the island, there continue to be instances of Jap suicidal infiltration forays. At 4 o'clock yesterday morning, an American officer, surprised in his sleep, was attempting to fend off a huge enemy infantryman who brandished a club. The Japs sneaked several hundred yards behind our advanced position. Before being momentarily knocked senseless, the officer noted that his assailant wore the World War I victory ribbon. Doughboys in adjoining foxholes killed their former ally and his two companions. 300 yards inland from the sea over the last beach he crossed, Ernie Pyle was laid to rest on Ieshima yesterday morning. While bullets whined and automatic weapons barked less than half a mile away, a little correspondent whom Americans loved so dearly was buried with Pyle's infantrymen during brief exercises attended by several hundred GIs. And a few yards beyond, where Ernie Pyle fell beside the road, they had erected a marker which read, "At this spot, this infantry unit lost a buddy, April the 18th, 1945. This is Leslie Nichols speaking from Okinawa. I return you to the United States.
That was war correspondent Leslie Nichols reporting from Ieshima in the Ryukyus. We turn now from the Battle of the Pacific to San Francisco, a city now swarming with activity in preparation for the United Nations Security Conference. For a commentary on this phase of the news, we present Mutual commentator Arthur Gaith speaking from the Mutual Newsroom in San Francisco.
Peace, not war, is rapidly absorbing the interests of thousands of world citizens gathering here in San Francisco. The first plenary session of the United Nations Conference of International Organization will be held here in the Opera House, presumably beginning at 4:50 p.m. Pacific War Time next Wednesday, at which delegates, as many of the public as can be accommodated, and press and radio will hear the President of the United States by radio, the Governor of the State of California, and other dignitaries bid the conference welcome. Then Thursday morning, a second plenary session will be held with greetings from Secretary of State Edward R. Stettinius, Jr., and the foreign ministers of the other big four nations, Russia, England, and China, nations which are sponsoring the meet. With the speeches out of the way, the conference will spend some time organizing, then undertake the time-consuming and arduous task of writing a charter or constitution by which the United Nations will be able to deal with their international problems. The big event in San Francisco yesterday was the arrival of Field Marshal Jan Christian Smuts, Premier of the Union of South Africa and one of the fathers of the League of Nations. The still-spirited 75-year-old leader, probably the most skilled of all the delegates of the conference in peace and war, caught the imagination of a large reception committee. Stepping from the Liberator, Trader Horn, with six other South Africans, Smuts snapped to attention and jauntily returned the salutes of numerous Army and Navy officers who joined with the State Department representatives in greeting him. Then he was whisked away to the Fairmont, where the South African delegation is staying, along with the American, Czechoslovak, Yugoslav, Belgian, and a number of others. The largest single group of visitors housed here so far is the Russian. 50 members of the Soviet Party arrived by plane yesterday. The St. Francis will become headquarters for the Russian delegation. It is their supply of vodka, caviar, other delicacies, their need for shoes being supplied by American ration stamps that is providing comment here. It was not until yesterday that the hotels began to feel the pressure of the conference. The flow of diplomats and press and radio people into the city has begun, and by Wednesday this city will really be in a jam. Like the fog which often settles over the Bay Area, the political differences which exist between the major powers are reflected in this conference city, but any dispelling of the clouds will originate from Washington, where the representatives of the Big Four have the Polish question to iron out. It will add immeasurably to the success of Anzio if the differences disappear and some representative Polish group is invited to San Francisco. Not that all the pressures will then disappear, for this city is rapidly filling up with representatives from many different factions and from all parts of the world. Monday, there will be a preliminary World Labor Conference over in Oakland, a reconvening of the executives who returned in March from the World Labor Congress held in London. They will issue a strong statement about the interests of labor in peace. Ely Culbertson, who has arrived, typifies the group that is here to press for the federative principle. The Dumbarton Oaks proposals call for world organization on the basis of a confederation. And Culbertson and other world federationists want a basis for organization similar to the one adopted when the United States of America was created, setting up a central power with specifically delegated responsibilities. Then there is the Indian group here, which will inveigh particularly against the British and appeal for Indian liberation and independence, attacking the British Indian delegation, which will speak for India at the conference. As never before, Americans will experience the different forces of the world working here in their separate behalfs, trying to influence the final outcome, the creation of a world charter on the basis of the proposals made at Dumbarton Oaks.
That was Arthur Gates speaking from the Mutual Newsroom in San Francisco, reporting on the preparations being made for the coming World Security Conference. And now briefly, to round out the news picture up to this moment, here are a few brief news flashes. In Italy, the Allies have captured Bologna, the first plum to fall to the new spring offensive. More than 300 flying fortresses of the U.S. 8th Air Force, escorted by 400 Mustangs and Thunderbolts, swept over Germany today and hammered Nazi rail facilities at Munich and Ingolstadt. American Strategic Air Force headquarters also announced that a German airfield at Munzberg was bombed. The American sweep followed on the heels of six separate heavy attacks against Berlin last night by British mosquito bombers. And that's the news up to this moment. Stay tuned to Mutual, the network for news, for more late word from home and abroad. You have heard from Jack Mann, Leslie Nichols, and Arthur Gate. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.